From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Five years ago, writer André Debuse pulled off the highway to help a couple of people who were in an accident. While helping them, he was hit by another car. The accident crippled him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the ways the accident changed his body, his life, and his writing. Also, we look at the state of writing and publishing in Czechoslovakia. Yesterday, the last Soviet troops pulled out of the country. We talk with novelist Ivan Klima, one of Czechoslovakia's best-known writers, and Michael March, who organized an international book fair in Prague last month. And book critic John Leonard reviews David Gates' debut novel, Jernigan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An agreement guaranteeing political rights to Iraqi Kurds appears to be on hold. Kurdish leaders say that Iraq has attached new conditions to the talks that the leaders say are unacceptable. From the Turkish-Iraqi border, Deborah Wong reports.
Kurdish leaders have said they were close to signing the accord, which would guarantee autonomy for the Kurdish region, including free elections. But this week it was reported that Baghdad has attached several new conditions in a secret appendix. The document requires the Kurds to support Iraq's ruling Ba'ath Party and to fight against Iraq's enemies, including Shiite rebels in the south. The document also requires the Kurds to turn over all of their weapons to the Iraqi army and to refrain from contacts with outside countries and organizations unless they receive permission from the Iraqi government. Kurdish leaders say the new conditions are unacceptable. They've reportedly rejected them in a letter to the Iraqi leaders, but so far have received no reply. I'm Deborah Wong in Chisray.
President Bush met today with members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who urged him not to lift economic sanctions against South Africa. The president told the black lawmakers that he has little flexibility to maintain sanctions once South Africa's government releases all political prisoners. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said after the meeting that the president intends to take a strict interpretation of the five conditions spelled out in the 1986 law that imposed the sanctions. California Democrat Ron Dellum said the law gives the president the authority to exercise some judgment about whether the conditions are actually being met. On Capitol Hill, environmental organizations have joined forces with a group of Democratic senators to launch a grassroots campaign against the energy package making its way through the Senate. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
The coalition contends that the bill passed by the Senate Energy Committee places too much emphasis on promoting nuclear power and drilling for oil in environmentally sensitive areas, and not enough emphasis on renewable energy and fuel efficiency efforts. Senator Howard Metzenbaum says the bill, authored by fellow Democrat Bennett Johnston and backed by the Bush administration, sets up a familiar battle.
Here we go again. It's the oil crowd and the nuclear crowd battling the rights of the people. I think it'll be one heck of a battle when it comes to the floor of the United States Senate.
The environmental groups deny suggestions that they've gotten a late start in organizing a grassroots effort against the Johnston bill. The full Senate is expected to take up the measure later this summer. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street as investors recovered from yesterday's big plunge. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 2,910. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Police in Northern Ireland said that as many as 14 people were injured in a bomb blast today in Belfast. The bomb went off outside a police station in a crowded shopping area during the noon hour. Two police officers were reported hurt, along with about a dozen passers-by. The Lord Mayor of Belfast accused the Irish Republican Army of planting the bomb. The IRA is outlawed, and its political arm, Sinn Féin, has been excluded from talks on the future government of Northern Ireland because of its refusal to disavow violence. The House of Representatives is expected to approve a bill that will quadruple grazing fees for ranchers who graze their cattle on federal land. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Supporters of the measure say it will save taxpayers $100 million a year and reduce erosion of rangelands. Opponents say that dramatically higher grazing fees will put tens of thousands of Western ranchers out of business. The hike in grazing fees is part of a bill that would fund the Interior Department for fiscal year 1992. Sponsor of the measure, Democrat Mike Sinar of Oklahoma, said the fees were a subsidized welfare program for ranchers. Ranchers currently pay below market rates for the privilege of grazing their livestock on about 300 million acres owned by the federal government. The House approved a similar measure last year, but the Senate rejected the plan. Critics of higher grazing fees predict the Senate will reject the measure again this year. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Commerce Department reported today that orders for durable goods were up in May for the second month in a row. The 3.8% boost was the biggest monthly increase since March of 1990. Durable goods are costly products such as cars and major appliances that are expected to last at least 3 years. The National Association of Manufacturers said that the growth in demand for durable goods is another sign that the economy could begin to recover in the third quarter. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sometimes there's an event in your life that is so tragic that as long as you live, you will think of your life as dividing into two parts, before and after. Writer Andre Debuse is living that kind of life. On a summer night in 1986, he was driving along a highway near Boston when he spotted a woman standing beside her car, which was stopped in the third lane. He pulled off the side of the road to see if anyone was hurt. The woman was bleeding and crying. She and her brother had hit a motorcycle. As the three tried to flag down more help, they were struck by an oncoming car. The brother was killed. The sister was uninjured. Debuse was crippled by the accident. He lost one leg and lost all use of the other. Andre Debuse has been helped financially in the intervening years by benefit readings of well-known writers who admire his work, like John Irving and John Updike, and by a MacArthur grant. But it's been very difficult for Debuse to resume writing. His first nonfiction book has just been published. It's a collection of old and new personal essays called Broken Vessels. This is the opening of a piece about the accident called Lights of the Long Night.
I remember the headlights, but I do not remember the car hitting Luis Santiago and me, and I do not remember the sounds our bodies made. Luis died, either in the ambulance or later that night in the hospital. He was 23 years old. I do not remember leaving the ground my two legs stood on for the last instant in my life, then moving through the air over the car's hood and windshield and roof and falling on his trunk. I remember lying on my back on that trunk and asking someone what happened. I did not lose consciousness. The car did not injure my head or my neck or my spine. It broke my right hand and scraped both arms near my wrist, so my wife believes I covered my face with my arms as I fell. I lay for a while on the trunk talking to a young man, then to a woman who is a state trooper. Then I was in an ambulance, stopped on the highway, talking to a state trooper, a man, while he cut my trousers and my right western boot. That morning, my wife saw the left boot on the side of the highway while she was driving home from the hospital in Boston. The car had knocked it off my foot. The state troopers got the boot from my wife, but I did not leave the hospital with a left foot or, below the middle of my knee, a left leg.
You know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that story instead of asking you to tell it is that I thought you might feel almost tired of telling the story about what happened to you.
I am.
Are you?
You know, 5 years I've been telling that story. Actually, I don't know if I ever, well, you know, in the first few years it used to scare me and I had to take a Xanax to tell it. And now.
It used to scare you just to tell a story?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And have you told it enough so that it's just a story now? I mean,
actually, I told it to some teenage girls I was teaching. This was only last fall. Ooh. I had a new girl that night. She asked what happened, and another girl started telling her because I didn't want to. But the other girl wasn't telling it right, so I told it. And when they left, I got very anxious, yeah, and I did, in fact, take a tranquilizer and then go check with a psychologist to see if what was happening was what I thought was happening.
Which was what?
I said, you know, they left, I started to pay bills, and I started getting very anxious, and I wondered what was wrong. And then I thought, well, you've just told a story about almost getting killed and told it at night, which I usually try to avoid doing, and it's messed you up.
Why is it harder to tell it at night?
Oh, I think it has to do with darkness and death. when I got home from the hospital in 86, in September, I got frightened every day at sunset and took a Xanax when the sun went down. And always assumed, no one's told me any different, that it's because I almost died. And I didn't like seeing the sun go down. And to this day, I sleep with my bedroom door open and all the shades up, because that not being, being closed in reminds me of the hospital, where there were windows, but, you know, they looked out over an alley. So, I mean, you know, there was window looking onto brick without much light.
Right.
I think so. I mean, you know, I was close.
This is the story of the moment that's probably most changed your life. And it's probably the story you've told the most, at least in the past few years. And I'm wondering how the telling of the story has changed over time.
It hasn't really changed much. Since writing that, I've come to terms with the lives of the other people involved. In other words, I've done some forgiving, which was necessary. Especially of the driver who ran over us. And, of course, she should be forgiven. It was only an accident, but, you know, I took it personally for about 8 or 9 months. But basically the story hasn't changed, but as I get now nearly 5 years from it, I'm even more deeply grateful and awed, because I've heard since then of so many other accidents. Grateful and awed that I was struck by a fast-moving vehicle on a highway and emerged as healthy as I did. I mean, you know, I should be dead.
So when you met the driver?
No, I never...
You never met the driver?
No, I never met her. I was brought up in Catholic school, so I learned as a little boy, you know, to pray for people you don't like. And I started doing that for her, using her name, because I really felt hatred. And I knew the only way to get rid of it was praying. And I never felt good about it when I was praying. But finally, after a few months, with some help from somebody else who was actually praying with me, I saw it from the woman's point of view.
In asking you about the telling of the story and how you tell it and how the telling has changed, I think one of the things I'm trying to find out is if you've tried to find a way of telling the story so that what people feel isn't pity but a larger sense of the fragility of life. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's ways of telling stories so that people feel sorry for you, and there's other ways of telling it so that they feel something larger than that.
Every time I tell it to somebody, it's always with awe and gratitude. I've met a lot of injured people since my injury because of the mutual help that we go for. And everyone I know who's crippled has used the word gratitude and grateful, because what happened to us was bad enough to have made things worse, you know. So... that's always the way I remember it. Well, I remember it with fear, too. And I never lost consciousness. A nurse told me no one ever remembers the point of impact, but I know two injured people who do, and I'm hoping that I never remember that.
Yeah, don't you think it's a blessing to not remember
I think
that?
It's a great blessing. I remember the headlights, and then I remember being on her trunk, and then learning that I never lost consciousness. So... my eyes must have seen, you know, that grill and hood and windshield coming, and I'm just very glad I don't remember that.
Now, you're a very literary man. I mean, you read a lot, you write a lot. And we know all about tragedy and the way people react to, you know, horrible things in their lives from literature, but that doesn't stop us from having to experience it when it happens to us. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
it doesn't
I do.
Save you from anything. Did you feel that, like, what you knew from literature, from, like, the greatest writing that you'd read helped you in any way?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. I think if I had been younger and had a different background, I may have had a worse response, or even older with a different background. growing up with in Christian Brothers schools, as I did, which were Catholic schools, growing up with the Passion of Christ as your example of this is how things are going to be, gives you the expectation of suffering. And then, you know, I started reading serious literature when I was about 18, and most of that is about what? People who love each other, people who hurt each other, people who lose. And so you could say I've been spending most of my spiritual and mental life dealing with suffering of others, from Christ to Natasha in War and Peace, right?
Has your reading changed in recent years?
Has my reading changed? Yeah. I tend to read more of the New Testament and less of anything else. The first year of my injury, I didn't notice it until someone said to me, "What are you reading?" And I said, "I'm only reading the New Testament and histories of Marines." And the guy said, "Well, that makes sense." And then I realized I was doing both for my spirit, trying to get courage, endurance, grace, patience, wisdom.
What did the history of the Marines give you?
Oh, vivid examples of people suffering and enduring and, you know, having true grit and resilience. I was in the Marines, so I needed, you know, I was never in the Marines in war, but, you know, I needed that spirit. It became very important to me after I got run over.
You've talked about forgiveness, and, of course, you know, there's a lot about forgiveness in the New Testament. How long did it take you to forgive the person who ran you down?
From July until the following May.
You're laughing in a way that's really not a very long time at all, you know.
No,
people can go through a lifetime without that kind of forgiveness.
That was pretty long. And, you know, I had... I'm also laughing because my anger wasn't really rooted in anything reasonable. I thought she should have sent me flowers or a card in the hospital, you know. But I'm sure her attorney, being what they are, said, you know, don't even lick a postage stamp with his name in your mind or else you're going to get messed up. And after some months, really, really only through prayer, and I don't want to sound like, you know, some freak, this is just very normal prayers. I mentioned her name every morning. And prayed for her because I knew that, you know, I couldn't go around hating somebody. It's just, it destroys you. You can't carry that around in your heart. And, you know, finally the grace came to me to be in the car as she would have been on that night driving. And then I realized, you know, she didn't do anything wrong. She had a bad night. You know, and she didn't do anything wrong either. She wasn't drinking. She wasn't on drugs. She just didn't see us. And it was a, you know, she didn't break any laws. There was never anything done to her.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer Andre Dubuis, and he's just published his first nonfiction book. It's a collection of essays, most of them very personal, called Broken Vessels. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Andre Dubuis. How long did it take you to start writing again after the accident?
Oof. I'm still working on that. I have been writing. I wrote 10 of those essays. I've written 4 stories. I got hit in July. I wrote a very short story in January. Well, actually, I was trying to write in the hospital. So I've always been writing since the accident. But it's been very difficult to create something whole. And I'm starting to understand now in my 5th year that the healing is long. I mean, people have told me this all along. that the body, the spirit, the mind are all damaged, and everything's going to come back slowly. But I'm starting to believe it now.
So is it mostly physical distress that's held you back from writing more?
I don't really know. Only in the past few weeks, this May, I've begun to feel some energy and peace that I have never felt since being hurt in 86. Begun to feel even almost like I used to feel, as well as I remember how I used to feel. On Thanksgiving of 86, Tobias Wolff, that wonderful, wonderful writer and friend, phoned me. I was still in a cast. I was home. I was hurting. And as soon as he said, "This is Toby," I started crying. I said, "Toby, I can't write. Why can't I write?" You know, this was 3-4 months after I got run over. He said, "Because your body's broken and your body and spirit are one, and they're both mending." And I think that's been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, I still have aches and pains and fatigue every day, but I think a new gift is coming. I really do. I think writing is going to become more what it was before I got run over than what it's been since I got run over, which has been like, you know, chasing a blowing piece of paper on a windy playground.
Well, one of the new pieces in your new collection, in one of those pieces you say that the best person for a crippled man to cry with is a good physical therapist. Have you gotten a new sense of what's best to bring to or to leave to a professional, you know, as opposed to someone who you're very intimate with, someone in your family?
I went to a professional psychologist in 89, which was nearly 3 years after the accident, because I woke up every morning crying, and one morning I couldn't stop. And so I guess I learned from that, you know, when you can't move, it's time to go to the professionals. What the professional did in 1 hour, though, was get me to contact two other crippled friends, and one came over 2 days later, taught me to drive a car. And so I saw this guy, the professional, probably for about 6 or 8 weeks. And, yeah, he was very good. He said, "You're not depressed. You're sad because you lost your legs, and you'll always be sad, and you'll never replace them," which is exactly what all the friends I called said. You know, you will always wake up missing your legs, and you will never get over that. And I had made the mistake of expecting one day to wake up as you do from the flu and say, "Wow, that was tough. Now I feel great. I'm myself again." And it never happened. So before I, you know, just lay there crying for a few days, I used to call myself a bad cripple. I was angry at myself for not being a cheerful cripple. Then I found out from the other guys who were more experienced cripples than I that they weren't cheerful either. They had just learned to expect to wake up feeling this, and expect to go through this each day and night, you know, the psychic pain, the spiritual, the physical. And it's nice to have that brother and sisterhood.
You use the word cripple to describe your condition?
I do, but I think that's because I'm a writer. I've never liked euphemisms. You know, I don't say passed away, I say dead. One of my older children came to me in the hospital and said, "You're not disabled, you're physically challenged." I said, "No, you're physically challenged. You're breathing hard from climbing the stairs. I'm disabled." My friends who are active disabled people like to be called disabled, so I call them disabled. But cripple is a good old-fashioned word for me, you know. And that's what I would have written before if I write a story about somebody who was crippled.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Andre Debuse, and he has a new collection of essays, and it's called Broken Vessels. I don't know, I guess it was a year or two after your accident, you were separated from your third wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
1 year, just about.
1 year. And I was wondering if you've thought a lot about whether it was the relationship or the accident that, you know, and how the accident changed the relationship, you know, that was responsible for the separation.
Yeah, I have, and it's not too personal a question. It's just one that I can't answer because I don't have the answers. The thing is about marriage is my own and everybody else's. I always assume there are so many mysteries that I will never understand anybody's any more than they do. So, you know, would we have would we still be married if I hadn't got run over? I don't know. I really don't know. I hope so. I don't know. I know the accident did something. And I know that I've only learned this spring, realized this spring, just thinking back on myself, that I was a little crazy for at least a year, but I think mostly most of two. And still am. Things get distorted when you've been on your legs for, nearly 50 years, and then all of a sudden you're sitting, you're always looking up at people, steps are always problems, bathrooms are always problems, traveling is horrendous, it's frightening, it's stressful, it's helpless. You're always in someone else's hands. The access is never right. You know, the world is not curbs. Well, of course, the world is eating, drinking, sleeping, being clean, emptying one's body waste, and all of that has to do with access. So, but, you know, this can get very boring to listen to, and it's actually been a problem with my writing. I've had a hard time in fiction. I was writing a story last fall about a woman with, a husband and three children. And my notes were to get everybody up in the morning and get breakfast and get that done in one paragraph. I went, Terry, 2,400 words before I got him out of the house. And I read those 2,400 words to my fiction workshop that meets at my house on Thursdays. And as soon as I finished reading it, I said, this is really about somebody in a wheelchair. I didn't know that. But it took me another month or so to realize that I was spending so much time. There were some pretty nice sentences there, too, but it's all madness. I was spending so much time on that story because I celebrated her getting out of bed and putting her boots on while standing up. Walking to the bathroom, standing up from the toilet, standing at the lavatory in the mirror, going downstairs, standing at the stove. I mean, you know, it was Ginger Rogers I was doing. I was choreographing. I thought, oh, my God, I've not only lost height perception, I can't tell how tall people are anymore, but I've lost the proper perspective for biped fictional characters.
Well, why not write fiction about somebody who is in a wheelchair, who is crippled? Why not? And why hold yourself back from that if it seems like that's what you're writing anyways?
Because I don't think I'll feel like I've gotten back until I can write something resounding about somebody who has legs. I think this is also the truth. Usually, as a writer, if something has really happened to me, I write about it in an essay. I usually write fiction about things that bother me about the world or fascinate me, but are not really very personal. So if I'm going to put somebody in a wheelchair, you know, I might as well just do an essay.
Let me ask you, is one of the great paradoxes of this accident that the accident has brought more attention to you and your writing, but at the same time it's made it more difficult for you to write?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I want to wish you the best with your health and with your writing and your new book and everything. And I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. And I wish the best to you.
Andre Debuse has a new collection of personal essays called Broken Vessels. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
When the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968, many Czech writers were forced underground. Samizdat literature became one of the most important expressions of the country's culture. This week, the last Soviet troops left Czechoslovakia. Coming up, we discuss the state of writing and publishing in that country now that the writers have emerged from the underground. We talk with Ivan Klima, one of Czechoslovakia's leading writers, and to Michael March, who organized an international writers' festival in Prague last month. And book critic John Leonard tells us what he thinks of a new American literary voice. He reviews David Gates' debut novel, Jernigan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A UN team says it has now identified more suspected nuclear sites in Iraq. As part of the agreement ending the Persian Gulf War, Iraq told the International Atomic Energy Agency that it had 24 nuclear facilities. One official says that UN experts identified one additional site in May and several more since then. The official says that the investigation will not be completed for several more months. The Yugoslav Federation, as it has been since the end of World War II, came to an end today with declarations of independence by two Western republics, Slovenia and Croatia. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli has more on the story.
The declarations of independence came in formal votes by the parliaments of the two republics, which proclaimed their sovereignty as two new European states. But the secessions have been widely criticized by the international community, which supports a united Yugoslavia. The United States and the European community have said they will not recognize an independent Slovenia or Croatia. The two republics had been pressing for a loose federation against the objections of hardline leaders of Serbia. Yugoslavia has a long history of ethnic strife. 22 people have died this year in clashes in Croatia, which has a large Serb minority which opposes the republic's secession, fearing its rights will be repressed. The federal parliament in Belgrade today urged the federal army to take steps to prevent the division of the country and changes of its borders. In Ljubljana, this is Sylvia Pagioli.
The American Medical Association has condemned a U.S. Supreme Court ruling barring federally funded clinics from discussing abortion with patients. Shirley Jihad of member station WBEZ reports that AMA members have approved a resolution on the issue during their meeting today in Chicago.
They say the issue goes beyond just abortion clinics. The concern is if government can dictate doctor-patient interaction on abortion, then the same thing could happen in other issues. So AMA Board of Trustee member Nancy Dickey says the association is launching a legislative battle to eliminate the gag order on abortion.
Obviously, we win some and we lose some, but this happens to be one that our patients have a great stake in, and we're going to exert every effort possible to make sure we try to win this one for our patients.
The AMA resolution adopted at the House of Delegates meeting in Chicago strongly condemns any interference by the government in efforts by doctors to offer treatment or information to patients. For National Public Radio, I'm Shirley Jihad in Chicago.
And the government says that orders for those so-called big-ticket items had a 3.8% gain in May. That's the largest increase in over 1 year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down close to 3 points to close at 2,910.11 in only moderate trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has turned down a call by President Bush to give police more leeway to conduct searches without a warrant. By a vote of 54 to 43, the Senate defeated a Bush administration-backed plan to allow the use of illegally seized evidence if police had a reasonable belief that they were abiding by Fourth Amendment protections. Opponents of the measure said that it would weaken individual rights. According to a new study, millions of older Americans with high blood pressure can reduce their chances of getting a stroke or heart disease with inexpensive medication. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Doctors don't usually treat one common type of high blood pressure, called isolated systolic hypertension, because until recently they didn't know it was harmful. But studies now show that the 3 to 4 million older Americans who have this kind of high blood pressure are more likely to get strokes or heart disease. A study published in today's Journal of the American Medical Association shows that people with this kind of hypertension can lower their risk of cardiovascular disease substantially by controlling their blood pressure. The study involved simple blood pressure medication, diuretics, but experts say drugs may not always be necessary. People with this type of high blood pressure should first try to lower it by losing weight, stopping smoking, and cutting back on alcohol and salt. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The wreckage of a luxury steamship that sank in Lake Erie back in 1852 has been found. Experts say that mud and fresh cold water have helped preserve the ship and its contents. The Atlantic was carrying 600 people when it collided with another ship in heavy fog. Only half of those on board the steamship survived. Officials of the salvage firm which found the wreckage say it could be worth up to $200 million, including $60 million in gold coins. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, the last Soviet troops pulled out of Czechoslovakia, 23 years after the first Soviet tanks rolled in. Many Czech writers fled after the invasion. Many of those who stayed were driven underground. Samizdat, the underground literature, became one of the most important expressions of Czech culture. Now that the writers have emerged from the underground, how is writing and publishing changing in the country? Earlier today, we called one of Czechoslovakia's best-known writers, Ivan Klima. During Prague Spring, he was the editor of the Journal of the Czech Writers' Union. His work was banned during the occupation, but it was popular in Samizdat and foreign editions. Now Klima is the head of the Czech chapter of the international writers' organization, PEN. We called him in Prague, and I asked him if he did anything to celebrate yesterday's final withdrawal of Soviet troops.
No, I did nothing, and as I know, nobody did nothing. I don't know why we were looking forward to this moment, but when it happened, so it was quite normal. So nobody celebrated anything, as I know.
You've said that during the communist rule, Samizdat was the only authentic voice of Czech culture.
Yes.
Now that culture isn't being suppressed by the government, does the novel have the same significance in your country as it did before?
It's a question. It's true that in the past the writing had another meaning. It means some political meaning. It was very often the only expression of independent spirit, free spirit. So, and that was the reason why there was such demand for this forbidden literature. Now, of course, the situation is changed. Nearly everybody has enough information. So I am sure that this importance of literature will a little decrease. But on the other hand, the interest for books has a very long tradition in our country.
You know, sometimes when in America, when you walk into a chain bookstore, you can sometimes get very depressed because some of the books that are really displayed are, you know, romance novels and how-to books, and you know, the serious literature doesn't usually sell as well as the pop stuff. What's it like for you now when you go into a bookstore in Czechoslovakia? What books are really being pushed?
The situation changed a lot since November. I mentioned we have much more titles now, but of course still it cannot be compared with the situation on your market. It's a lot of trash now on the market, which was also oppressed by old regime. It's mostly discussed so-called pornography, which is a very soft still now, and some real trash, some crime stories and bad science fictions and so on.
I like the way you say that you think trash was oppressed during communism. So you're glad that there's an open market now for science fiction, even if it's bad science fiction, and for softcore pornography, and for all the popular books.
I must say I accept the situation, and I have a feeling if somebody likes to read pornography, so why not? If somebody likes to read trash, why not? I think it's a freedom.
What are some of the personal ups and downs
you've been through as a writer in the past 2 years with the new freedom that you have?
I shall not be 100% serious. If we were persecuted by police, but not hunted by newspapermen, and we had a lot of troubles, but a lot of time for concentration, because our phone was disconnected. We had our passports were confiscated. We couldn't travel, and so really we had a lot of time for writing. I mentioned I'm not so serious. Now we have freedom. Nobody persecutes us, but the situation is so exciting for us, and we are so busy to answer many questions from Czech newspapers, Czech mass media, and when I am asked by many of my friends, mostly from abroad, about a new Czech literature, so I have to answer. It doesn't exist. Nothing new was written because nobody has time to write.
What can you tell us about how your books were published and how they were circulated underground as Samizdat?
Yes, so we started this whole activity in the beginning of the 70s. It started just in my flat by readings. And it was always for limited number of people who came to visit me, and somebody always has read something, either poetry or some short story and so on. And we found, and it was after some time, it was known to police, and they interrogated some of my guests. So we decided to stop these readings, and instead of it, to start written edition of these books, which were written in that time. And the circulation was in the beginning very low, about 30, 40 copies. We used only typewriters, because everything else was forbidden, and it was rather dangerous to use some more sophisticated technique.
Do you have any copies of your underground editions of your books?
Yes, I have nearly all these books in my bookshelf, but they are some of them are nearly destroyed by readers. I can say by hundreds of readers, because it was written on this special paper, which is used for airmail, because it was the best paper for copying. We succeeded to make about 13 or 14 copies on this paper.
You know, it's funny looking at this from a capitalist perspective. The Samizdat editions will probably be worth a lot of money.
Yes, and I am sure that it will be by bibliophiles. And now it will be something which will be estimated very high. I am sure that if I intend to sell some of these copies, I can get a lot of money for it. Because it's really very rare.
Would you sell it?
No, I don't intend to. I don't like to have money.
You don't like to have money?
I have more than I need, and I need nearly anything.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No, I was very glad I had this opportunity, and I send the greetings to all of your listeners and your audience, and I apologize for my English.
Your English is very good. The phone line is noisy, but your English is fine.
Thank you very much, and I hope that the line was not so bad. So, goodbye.
Ivan Klima spoke to us from his home in Prague. His latest novel, Love and Garbage, was just published in America by Knopf. We'll talk with the organizer of a book and writers festival in Prague after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Last month, Prague was the site of an international book and writers' festival, which was organized by Michael March. March is an editor and translator. He edited the new book, Child of Europe, an anthology of Eastern European poets. We called him at his home in London to get his sense of how writing and publishing has changed in Czechoslovakia since the end of communist rule. I wanted to know if he agreed with Klima that writers are still too busy dealing with the changes of democracy to have the time to develop a new literature of democracy.
The literature takes time in any circumstance, and the literature is always new in the sense of discovery. What is happening now is that people are confined to the economic realities, the period of transition, the social reorganization, and even basically reassessing the wounds that have occurred over 40 years. So much of the writing has become journalism. It's become a very political tool, which is necessary at the moment. So the long novels, the thoughts, the poetry must take a different direction, and this direction will take time.
When you're saying that people are turning to journalism, do you mean that the people who used to be writing the novels are now writing journalism, or is it a completely different writer that's getting read now?
Well, probably the writers who are being read are journalists for the simple reason that the moment is one of immediacy. There's a change. The change is not only has it not been digested, but the direction is still quite amorphous. No one knows where things are leading. So that many writers have turned to journalism, and people in general have turned to journalism because writing is now free. The media is much more free than it used to be, so that they can turn to television, they can turn to newspapers for information, which previously was only in the codes of samisat and poetry and very much underground. Now things are above ground. The other aspect is this, that publishing is going through a very, very awkward period because paper has become much more expensive. It's not being subsidized. Writing is not being subsidized. So that the cost of books have become increasingly costly. And also life has become increasingly costly.
Can you describe what bookstores look like now in Prague compared to what they looked like under communism?
Well, they're probably much more empty now. Basically, one must remember that the communist regime set up publishing houses as tools of propaganda, and it worked both positively and negatively. Positively, in the sense, of course, they supported books; they supported the price of books, so that books were available. And not all books were bad under the system, because the communists did publish very, very young writers, and they published very young poets. And within poetry, there was almost a genetic code which could escape the censor. So in one sense, they were cutting their own throats by subsidizing books, because nothing can take the substitute of good literature, which means that music can disappear like perfume, paint can remain cracked on workers' hands. But the word can hide a code and can hide within its vast circumference a nation. And that's what literature really did. So the problem now is that with a deregularization of prices, with the basic rocketing of paper prices and printers' fees and so forth, the book itself has become a very, very charming object, such as perfume, a very expensive object. And all the constraints, the economic constraints on society, have basically taken the book away from the browser, away from the student, away from people who naturally were inclined for books in one respect. And it made it much more of a, not only a sacred object, but an unattainable object, because it's become much more expensive. And it's more expensive for publishing houses to even take the risk in publishing good literature. That includes literature in translations from other countries other than the United States and Great Britain, which will always be greatly popular in Czechoslovakia.
As someone who follows Eastern European literature as closely as you do, are you depressed to find that literature seems to lose some of its meaning when freedom comes?
Well, being a great pessimist, one sees freedom in relative terms, and each society must question its own freedom. Western culture must question the role of the writer is one of a witness, and the role of a writer is to always question. So there's always going to be questions to be asked, and one must be very resourceful to ask the proper question. But for myself, within Eastern Europe, I would say I'm not disappointed in the slightest. Well, I'm very, very pleased that there's a chance for people, the population, to have more of a normal life. But this life and this normalcy will take quite some time to settle in. As for writers, they will return to the universal themes of pain and suffering and life and death, and they also will delve deep into the area of subconsciousness, which perhaps they didn't have to previously delve in so deeply. But writers, like trees, will blossom and flourish without question. And it will take different turns. But there's still, Eastern Europe is still, for us, a very mysterious landscape. There are very many traditions. The traditions which Kafka unearthed in terms of replacing tragedy, basically replacing tragedy with humor, which came from the Talmud, and then basically replacing all of this with the concept of an increasing bureaucracy. This is a form which is very, very East European and extremely westernized now. And all of these areas will have to be explored once more in throughout Eastern Europe.
Michael March spoke to us from London. He edited the new book Child of Europe, an anthology of Eastern European poets. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio's All Things Considered in Washington, with a word about our program this evening. In Yugoslavia, the republics of Croatia and Slovenia have declared themselves to be independent of Yugoslavia, presenting lots of problems, especially for the Republic of Serbia, which has demanded the republic stay together as a nation. Difficulty in the Philippines between the U.S. military and the town of Olopango. Difficulty in Los Angeles between Koreans and blacks there. NPR's Katie Davis has that report. Also, an interview about direct broadcast satellite, a plan to broadcast radio by satellite to Africa and the Middle East, direct to radios that could receive the signals. The receiving dish would be right inside the radio itself. That and other news coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
You may have read David Gates' articles about music and art in Newsweek magazine. Now his first novel, Jernigan, has been published. Book critic John Leonard says it's a powerful start.
Not by accident. This scary first novel comes with blurbs from Joseph Heller and Frederick Exley. Like Heller's Something Happened, it depicts the dead soul in the gray flannel suburbs. Like Exley's A Fan's Notes, it fuels its fantasies with alcohol. John Cheever's Bullet Park and Richard Yates's Revolutionary Road also come to mind. Where there ought to be happy faces, there is instead a wasteland, what David Gates calls the usual bloat and disgust. And who is David Gates? From the newspapers, although not from the jacket of Jernigan, we learn that his favorite writer is Samuel Beckett, that he used to be married to the novelist Ann Beatty, and that he's not himself an alcoholic. An interesting item of information, since what we're reading is supposed to be 39-year-old Peter Jernigan's account of everybody he ever hurt, including himself, in his career of self-destructive drinking, as written from the hospital in a therapy program for alcoholics. It's a long list, and not a pretty one. Jernigan has reasons, but not excuses. Jernigan is inexcusable. Among his many problems in New Jersey are a dead wife, a girlfriend who kills rabbits for a living, a teenage son in a rock band, frostbite, too many episodes of Star Trek, and the inability of anybody around him to understand his literary references. Jernigan makes so many literary references, to Beckett, to Chekhov, to Wallace Stevens, to Jane Austen and E.M. Forster, because he should have been a poet instead of doing whatever it is he does in the city involving real estate. But he's more than a failed artist. He's a failed human being. Bloated and disgusted, he can make fun of almost anything. Malls, sex, psychiatry, country music, modern art, teen suicide, the New York Times, even, in the bedroom, a wicker laundry basket with a pantyhose foot dangling from under the lid, as if someone were being swallowed. But the joke's on him. This leads to self-pity and self-hatred and more gin and bad news. He finds it impossible to believe that his son could love him, and he isn't the least bit interested in saving himself. For what? Well, Peter, says his girlfriend, between rabbits, you can't just live your life in a cringe, waiting for stuff to happen. I really believe that's a way of inviting stuff to happen. To her, to everyone, Jernigan replies, right out of Beckett, I can't go on, I'll go on. And so he does, all the way to the hospital, where he's asked to identify himself by his spiritual disease, and he replies with his own name. Is Jernigan our fault? I mean, did the suburbs drive him crazy? Or late capitalism? Or modern excessive America? Has he somehow been let down by the poets and playwrights and novelists he's always quoting, who are always so much more vivid and resourceful than he can manage, who seem to have found in language a way not to die, an escape hatch, Houdini-like? Not really. As Jernigan himself points out, simply having a job needn't numb you. Obvious example, Wallace Stevens. Any dead-ass drudge can feel worse about himself by thinking about Wallace Stevens. Circling around himself, Jernigan is his own metaphor, like all drunks. Nor really does he want to sober up. Irony isn't courage. The horror of this novel is that now when I look into the mirror, instead of Hamlet or Robin Hood, I'm more likely to see Jernigan.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Jernigan by David Gates. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with associate producers Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Worried about salmonella in your eggs, pesticides in your salad, chemicals in your water? On the next edition of Fresh Air, we get some advice from Michael Jacobson. He's the executive director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest and one of the authors of the new book, Safe Food. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.